January 26th, and welcome to another episode of the Academic Podcast. My name is Sarah, and Sam is not with us today. However, we do have a special guest.
What courses are you taking right now?
I have a course on Disneyland, reading Disneyland as a text.
Fun!
Yeah, not my bag. There's usually like one reading.
That's good. And is that the only course you're taking right now? Or?
No, so also a course on the comparative literature.
You did your undergrad at University of Calgary in film studies as well. Okay. Oh, okay. That's a nice compliment. Do you feel like that compliments, or was that just...
It was part of a long process of choosing what I wanted to do. I started in philosophy, but I really hated the program. You see, it's very analytic. So then I do psychology because I really grew to hate it. But I'd already done about half of it by the time I realized it's just another kind of, you know, garbage. So then I had been taking a lot of film classes. I worked it so that I was able to get both degrees.
Separately. Wonderful. So. And do you find there's a difference between the film studies program at UW? What are the differences? If they're similar, what are...
So when I was there, three professors.
In film studies?
Yeah.
Wow.
We did it. The year after I left, there was two.
Wow.
And next year, they hired on two new people. So there's four professors who do film
Slow
now.
Slow down, film studies. Yeah. I hope they're tenured.
Two of them are.
Okay. incestuous department.
Yeah, it felt really homey, you know, because it was literally a couple who was running it, and the third guy who was there when I was there was a friend of theirs from grad school.
Wow.
So there was just very little network of us students who would always hang out.
Right.
So there was just very much like a big...
That's fantastic. So it's like a community program. Yeah.
So but it was very small. There's so many professors. It's hard. The grad program is much smaller.
Right.
Courses were, so one of the first courses I ever took, which to me is strange, like the University of Calgary in the heartbed of Alberta, you wouldn't really expect that to be,
right.
But apparently it is.
Well, there is this phenomenon that the smaller the program, or restriction that they have from a faculty member. So I guess today's episode will concentrate on as a discipline should be, or are they? is it just another way to kind of... approach relevant to a profession, but I feel like we should kind of address it as a field, and you being the expert, that you could tell us what film studies is, and also what are the basic tenets of it, seriously as a field, and then you can, of course, a historian, I would love it if you can historicize studies in general, outside of academia. feel free to with wherever you feel comfortable.
One of the three, as far as North America is concerned, what their industries are like.
Maybe their budgets are...
The budgets are different. Definitely just the dollar numbers.
Yeah.
They also have 13 sets some way.
Wow.
They'll just remake it. Which is really funny, because then if you find one movie you like, if it's really popular, there's a good chance you'll find...
A Tamil version.
A couple other versions.
Wow.
And whoever makes it first is up to question, because it's not just like just making all these main ones and then everybody's copying. And oftentimes, actually, Tamil will be the first. But either way, there's just so much money going into this. There's so much money going into making it and then into watching it and viewing it, or at least something to watch movies. Most people still go to movies. Netflix is this huge phenomenon. And intellectual property rights are this huge issue, and oftentimes it's surrounding film. And so if we're putting this much of our time and money...
It's shaped by culture, but it's also a culture shaper. So when...
As far as academically is concerned, my understanding of a growing interest... Western Marxism and particularly Lacanian theory, kind of taking those up to look at a number of reasons specifically why those were taken up for film is suited it in a very strange particular way. Talking about how into the cinema and watching a film reflective of so psychoanalytically the way that relationship functions, or how we're looking at this screen that is, you know, reflecting our culture, so how does it reflect mirror stage?
So I guess your psychology background kind of plays an important role in that particular aspect of the field.
If psychology, and if modern psychology cared to teach people about psychoanalysis, which it doesn't, really.
No, unfortunately. No. So what are the basic principles within film studies? How is it historicized, the theories of film studies? Is film studies classic? We would like to know.
There's always been a concern over the technology, mm-hmm. or the technological basis about. Oftentimes that's in relation to its quality, the way it's, you know, capturing reality in this technological process that's supposed to be, in our understanding of it from different perspectives, either has no effect of an artist or, you know, has a different effect of an artist from, say, painting. But also early, a single person viewing film strip through a box, mm-hmm. and it wasn't, whereas the Lumiere brothers. So concerns over how those, just the very technical basis of it functions and how that interacts with exhibition modes, which has caused a lot of recurring issues over technological advancements. So
yeah.
Changes in color, changes in the addition of sound, the digital revolution, smell-o-vision, and all of these, you know, ridiculous things.
The potential.
Yeah, there's always a crisis when something happens. So
yeah.
When sound was coming in, you know, half of all people writing about film at the time were just like, well, this is it. Cinema's dead now.
Right.
Because cinema's a silent art, but now mm-hmm. it's going to have sound. That says goodbye to the visual.
Right. And I mean, I saw the artist over the summer outside being screened on King Street. There was something really cool about watching it on, you know, outdoors on a projector. Jean de Desjardins, I mean, him alone, I'll go see anytime. He's just stunning, beautiful specimen of a human being.
He's charming.
Very, very attractive. Having said that, it's interesting that with today's technology, you know, we're still kind of reflecting on the history of cinema and the sound panic, as you...
Yeah, the sound panic. it just was a huge panic. Because I think more than digital, it changed what cinema was. Like, digital changes things to
right.
a degree, a lot. Still currently, there's a lot of academic discussion over what digital does. But sound, I think, was more, it had more of a direct effect on everybody.
Yes.
Right? How, and while digital obviously has effects in production, because it makes
right.
everything cheaper and kind of easier in certain ways, and all the way down to distribution. But sound did, of course, was a dramatic change in how, just before sound came in, they had just kind of gotten mobile cameras.
Right.
So you're seeing more motion in films. But once sound hits, the technology for capturing sound on set was so bad that you couldn't move cameras because you had to put them in boxes, soundproof boxes.
So that, extract sound, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so that the mic wasn't picking up sound because the mics weren't directional enough.
Right, at that particular
yeah, injunction. So you see, like, the very form that films have suddenly stops
wow.
and regresses, right?
Right,
to, like,
yeah.
something that it was before. So, of course, it just seems like such a terrible thing, which is also kind of reflective of once we had video.
Right.
And people were making independent films with video, and they look like garbage because they're on video pressing in
yeah,
a certain way.
Yeah, in a way.
Of course, it becomes an...
I wonder if sound, you know, the fact that another sense was triggered.
It depends on the context, right? Because in like a pre-sound film,
mm-hmm.
you'd have...
Right.
And all sorts, like, depending on the neighborhood even... you know, racial issues.
Right.
So if you were in a black neighborhood theater, it would be a different type of band that was playing for the movie.
Wow. For the same movie.
For the same movie, yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Because it wasn't traveling, like the movie wouldn't travel with whoever. It was mm-hmm. kind of the exhibitor responsible for. And different cultures had different, if I recall correctly, this is from a long ago memory. Japanese cinema had its own kind of model for exhibition, and there would be employed by the theaters to...
Oh,
basically,
on top of the silent film.
Yeah, and I think that there is a number of,
it's
called that, affected how that was different for other countries and should expect that.
Right.
And so sound definitely changes it because now the sound is coming from the film in the
right.
exhibition.
And it's exactly how the director wanted it, how the screenwriter wanted
yeah,
it.
However the, whoever is in charge, whoever has the power over that project.
Yeah.
And yeah, so it takes away, like, there's always sound,
yeah.
quote unquote, but not particular specific sound.
Mm-hmm.
So when we look back at classic silent films, different versions, because I have two copies of Chien and Delu, for instance, an audio track, the original idea Salvador Dali had,
mm-hmm.
and then the one that they sing to in the 60s when it was... quote unquote restored. Oftentimes when you get an old silent film, that's something a lot of the commentary of
mm-hmm.
what audio track did they use. Because if you're watching especially an experimental film, really matters what you're using as a song, because if you're using an experimental film that maybe is kind of tongue-in-cheek,
right,
and you use a really somber track, yes,
right, yeah,
so it really matters. And a lot of those times for the experimental ones, the people who made them would be there when they're exhibiting, so they choose the music as a bit more of a bit more variation over the old model and the new model. It made a lot of.
What about the prominent theorist, your classic theorist that you have to study as a student?
There's definitely the ones we have to study. So.
Or you're forced.
Yeah, we are definitely forced. In my undergrad, there was two theory courses.
Mm-hmm.
Two theory courses and an intro course, of course, that kind of covered figures,
right,
in a sense. In the intro course and DAing an intro course here right now that uses the same book. So everybody starts on David Gordwell.
Do you apologize to your students?
Yeah.
Sorry, I have to teach you this.
It's a full year course and we only had to use that book for the first semester.
Mm.
And then the first 2 weeks of the semester we had to read readings by this guy.
Oh, lovely.
And, I remember on the last one. So just last week, I was just so happy. I was like, we are finally done with this piece of shit. He's over. I am sorry for last semester. Now we can get into good stuff.
Did you do a public burning?
Oh, I would love to. I mean, I should also be careful what I say. David Bordwell is who we're talking about. And he's one of the biggest. He's still active. Mm-hmm. He's still writing.
Right.
He's very prominent, and he changed the face of film studies when he really started.
Are you saying that like critically, or he actually, in your opinion,
he actually did change. Oh, okay. Yeah. No, his influence is certainly felt. I mean, that's one of the reasons we have to read him.
Okay.
Everybody starts with him as an intro because mm-hmm. he kind of positioned himself in such a way as to be like, this is how you start.
Worship me.
Yeah. There's usually, I've noticed students do have a kind of rebellion period against him on that, because value to what he's saying, certainly, it's not that he's, and the way he structures where he's coming from, so the way he structures it is he kind of necessarily agree with the way he structures,
right,
you know, what he's
of
doing.
Of course.
And yeah, it's unavoidable. You have to read David Bordwell. He's kind of the formalist he's the guy who you read to learn how to talk about the form, and there's quite a long the back, for sure. And there's I've had a few professors who are reasonably formal mm-hmm. in their approaches. I think.
No, of course not. No,
I think it's very important. But there's always kind of I remember very well a few of those professors have always send a PDF of the glossary just to remind students, like, when we're talking, use the words.
Look it up, boys and girls. Yeah.
So that's kind of everybody's entrance. It's supposed to be like the kind of unbiased, depoliticized, this is how we talk about film approach.
Supposed to be.
Yeah, when you depoliticize anything, it's political.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Bullshit. But it is it is what it is. And then in theory, it's always starting prior to the academic, kind of like a view of how a film was talked about. And there, as a result, the people who are talking about it are sometimes, and maybe not even surprising, but just they're known for other things.
Right.
So Walter Benjamin comes up simply because of his talk about aura, the article, but something about art in the age of technical reproducibility. So he's unavoidable. people like Jean Epstein comes up. He was a filmmaker. The really early guys are not my bag. Siegfried Krakauer comes up a lot. And then, of course, you move into more of the kind of established academic writing, which is people like Baudry and what is that name? Christian Metz.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Wolin comes up a lot, as well as his partner, who did The Gaze. I cannot remember the name though. Names are escaping me.
That's quite all right. In your opinion, is film studies like an interdisciplinary field?
Largely.
Yeah.
There's always a lot of. I mean, at a lot of points in time, it almost just functioned as a literary studies in certain ways, where a lot of people, when they were talking about film, they'd stop even talking about the specificity of it being a film. which is one of the critiques Bordwell actually came back with when he pushed the formal approach.
Right.
So, and he's kind of right. You can't just talk about the story or the narrative of what the film is.
Yeah.
You need to talk about the way it's presented. Mm-hmm. Which, and that's not always been a problem, mind you. And a lot of the people whose names I was forgetting there, like the Baudry and the Christiane Metz.
The Giants,
they always did have a relationship to some sort of film-specific quality. Mm-hmm. So the structuralism of Christiane Metz was about how film was structured. So it did matter, nature of film. He might have talked about those structures differently than Bordwell would.
Right.
But it was still concerned with that. if I could just remember who did The Gaze Theory. She's got a huge name in all of this, so it's,
I'm sure
you know, it's super ironic. But, I mean, hers was especially concerned with how film was looking. And, you know, that was a feminist psychoanalytic theory about scopophilia and the way women are framed in relation to how men are framed in films and how they're seen looking at one another. Women are filmed with a to-looked-at-ness, and men are filmed as, like, active agents.
With it, yeah.
So, you know, and so there's a lot of crosstalk with and psychoanalysis. Baudry, there'd be a ton of crosstalk with psychoanalysis.
Right.
Because Baudry was apparatus theory, and he was largely basing it off of analysis, as well as, even more importantly, Althusser's idea of...
I do have Althusser here, actually.
It's, unavoidable name.
Yeah, I mean, French Marxism comes in my field, but I appreciate more of his approach to the state apparatus.
I mean, that's what hailing was a part of, because when you're hailed as a subject in the apparatus or whatever, and so the ideological state apparatus, Baudry suggested that cinema is one of those. And so
absolutely.
His apparatus theory was how the actual exhibitionary apparatus of, like, the screen and the projector in this dark room, how it functions psychoanalytically to be an ideological apparatus.
Right.
So, yeah, there's always this crosstalk.
Between.
Christiane Metz was...
So that, I guess, triggers me to ask you something about, you know, Gramsci and the hegemony production.
I don't know Gramsci.
Well, some theorists have said that Althusser's state apparatus, similar to Antonio Gramsci's theory of hegemony and production of specific consent media, I mean, the press obviously plays an important role, and why not media? Why not? I would argue that that theory can be actually traced to a Muslim scholar, Ibn Khaldun, but you can see the influence of states' involvement in producing some kind of, like, consent through cultural interplay, evident as far back as the 1300s. At least theoretically, people are kind of, like, beginning to analyze that. And, I mean, Althusser, and then you can see how, you know, Foucault apparently was a student of Althusser, and you can see how that theory continues to evolve.
So many of them were.
Yeah. He killed his wife, Althusser.
Did he?
Yeah. This routine of him giving her a...
no defense, huh?
He was sick. Apparently, someone in his diary, he had...
Oh.
Yeah.
When you think the people around you are not who they say they are?
No, when you think you're not who you present yourself, you are.
Oh.
Yeah. Apparently, imposter syndrome is very common amongst grad students, Dylan.
Wonderful.
So when you think, like, you're fooling everyone into thinking that you know what you're talking about, but regardless, I digress. But it's really interesting how, you know, film studies does rely on those major theorists.
Yeah.
Just like history or philosophy, of course, sociology. So in a way, film studies came out during that period when field studies was becoming a thing.
I mean, it really comes out at a time when critical theory is just, and it kind of took that approach.
Mm-hmm.
I One of the courses I took in my undergrad was an English course called Critical Theory.
Oh.
And I think that course was one of the ones that really conceptualized what film studies was doing more than anything else. Film theory in that class, for one. But also it was just thing, right? Mm, definitely built out of that.
What about the actual production of film? What can we learn from the technology, the crisis that film studies
goes through?
Right. But what about the actual technology that, you know, is a limit to the budget? What does that self, the actual content, or does it tell us anything?
Yeah, anecdote. I have. we were in my, one of the ones we showed.
We can look it up.
Yeah.
But Dancer in the Dark.
Yeah, he did Dancer in the Dark. Filmmaker who made Hitler jokes at Cannes 1 year. Very, you know, foolish man at times.
Oh.
Great filmmaker.
Right. Was that with Kristen Dunst?
Yeah, he said he was making a porn with her, but then he just made that was not a porn.
Oh, okay. I know.
But he did
make
Nymphomaniac years later, which is kind of porny. And did have, you know, unsimulated sex in it, so. Lars von Trier.
There it is.
So Lars von Trier, he got
It's funny how you remembered as soon as you said strange man, and he remembered.
It's what he is. Von Trier started in this, like, fairy movement, which was him and another filmmaker, and they wrote this really aggressive manifesto about how to properly make a film. This is what a real film is.
Okay.
And there's, like, 10 rules or so. One was nobody gets put down as a director, like nobody's an author of it. Plot along, things that are in the area, no artificial. This kind of like really puritanical, you know, view, which is supposed to be like highly realistic. And he made a second Dogma film. And there's maybe 30 or so of these things around. And the idea was that people would make a film and then submit it. And then they'd give their seal of approval. And it didn't have to hit every single mark. It just had to like fall in the spirit.
Agree with the manifesto.
Yeah. Function like, so even though there was rules, it's not actually rule-based. It's not legalistic.
Right.
It's just, you know, getting this idea across. Or so they said. And, you know, there's even an American filmmaker, Harmony Korine, he has. Either way, we watched Dancer in the Dark, which is after this Dogma period, you know.
Right.
And he's not making these films anymore, very clearly. Especially with something like Nymphomaniac, which is, you know, a two-part, six-hour, like, monolith of a film. And everything that Dogma speaks against.
The anti-manifesto.
Yeah.
Wow.
And when we watched Dancer in the Dark, we were talking about it. Really great guy.
Yeah.
And he made this comment about Dogma 95 when we were there, and he said, oh, yeah, because somebody made a comment about, like, how do we understand this in relation to Dogma? Like, why is he not, you know, was that just, like, a youthful, you know, energy that went away? And then he made the comment, you know, kind of sarcastically, like, yeah, well, look what happens when you have a budget. All of a sudden, you're not bound to these rules.
Right.
So there's always this question.
It is interesting how they try to kind of, you know, rally up when budget is limited, and then money does bring that freedom to kind of do whatever.
Yeah, there's something to say, like, was Dogma 95 legitimate, or was it just the way that these guys tried to legitimize their low budget
things? Yeah.
Because, you know, low budget things are often derided for certain issues that are come from having a low budget. But if you have a manifesto backing you, maybe it looks a little bit more
intentional.
Justifiable.
Yeah.
So Dancer in the Dark is a very interesting movie, you know, and it has Bjork in it. It's like a musical, but it's not at all a musical. That's the anti-genre.
Right.
And there's just a lot. Like so it really doesn't. Movies increasingly, if you do have unlimited resources, like he's kind of for more and more, then we see his movies changing.
Yeah.
There is kind of like that question, don't have that. Like, what about movies that aren't limited, and what about movies that are project to project? Some films do have this, but it's not going to be Avengers, and they have unlimited resources, you know. Hard question to answer.
Budget does play a huge part.
The budget plays a huge part, and it also, but it's not the only part.
Of course not, right.
So, you'll have, you'll have very seeming films that are actually, like, surprisingly cheap, right?
That are low budget.
It's really a complicated relationship because budget plays such a huge part into what you're able to do, depending on what you want to do. And, of course, with digital now, and that technology, better and better.
And cheaper.
Becoming less of an issue in certain circles. I mean, when we're talking about Hollywood productions, there used to be the road budget, right? And those don't exist anymore. It's kind of been a common critique of modern Hollywood is there's no more of these middle budget films for directors cut their teeth and improve themselves.
There was a recent horror movie, I don't remember what it was called, but it was only on an IMAX.
Like, and all of it is on Skype call sort of thing?
Yeah. You know, I wonder if whatever budget they had did come from Apple.
Right.
Yeah.
This product placement sort of thing. That's hard to say. I mean, found footage as a horror genre is very popular right now.
Yeah.
Blowing up everywhere. The VHS movies are a great example of that. The Paranormal Activities of the world. Of course,
it started with, well, I don't know if it started, but The Ring.
Yeah, The Ring has an influence on that. I mean, if we go back to, I mean, found footage stuff has a very complex history that I don't want to pretend I know very well. And there's multiple forms of found footage when we're talking about that. But one of the early ones I always point to, I understand kind of, especially in relation to what we have now, called Cannibal Holocaust.
Okay. I feel like that sounds familiar, but yeah, remind me.
It's really infamous. It was one of those, like, banned movies, I think. It's basically three or four, I think it's like three guys and a woman. They go, they're like ethnographers, basically. And they go to some, to like film and...
Okay.
And so the movie is really this guy who's been hired by this production type company, distributor, to go through their footage and see if it's salvageable to make this movie that they kind of agreed with these people to make.
Right.
Right, because they were killed while they were making this movie.
Okay.
And so...
Or is that what the footage will have us believe?
Well, this is the thing, actually.
Cannibal Holocaust!
This is the interesting thing about Cannibal Holocaust is we see the actual... The found footage functions as found footage in the narrative, right?
Okay.
So the frame of Cannibal Holocaust is this guy having meetings, and we see that like three scenes of that. But the rest of the movie is actually just footage
from the discovered.
These people. And as the footage goes on, we see them kind of encountering these people and them interacting with each other. But each subsequent kind of shows them to be worse and worse.
Okay.
So, in one scene, they, like, grab a turtle out of the water, and they, like, they're really disgusting with it, and they just kind of, like, they do kill a turtle on camera, too.
Right.
Which some people have an issue with. Peel off the shell and just kind of...
Nuts.
Yeah, not really, like, in a rational way, just in a sort of, like, overly aggressive way.
Right.
One of the... Like, the woman and one of the men are a couple. So one of the scenes, and of course this is from, like, the 60s or something, right?
Right.
So they're, like, having sex, and then the other guy's like, see you, but they don't stop.
Right.
And so we're supposed to understand there's impropriety here.
Yeah.
And then it just continually gets worse. So the two other guys, when they're dealing with something, this one woman, using the married guy, who's, like, with his wife there, for, like, not joining in. So then he does join in, but she's really mad at him. Then she leaves. But then later, one of the clips is, like, him raping her because she's mad at him and doesn't want to have sex. So, like, it just gets, like, increasingly worse.
And worse, yeah.
To the point where they're, like, abusing more ways, physically as well and whatever. To the point that the natives...
Right.
Equipment. Because I think the natives also... It's either implied or directly stated that they thought on-camera classic kind of trope.
Right. And there's, of course, the racial element there in a colonial context that is being...
And so the movie ends with the guy who's going through the footage being like, this is not salvageable. These are terrible people.
Yeah.
We should burn and get rid of this.
We should, yeah.
Because there's, like, we should not be remembering these people.
And then there's a question that, you know, the question of violence, you know, as the film goes on, part of, you know, the white colonial context, or is this trajectory of the colonial context in the sense, like, oh, the cursed natives or the Aboriginal.
Right. It's actually kind of funny. The movie ends with this line, I think, if I remember correctly. He says, like, he's, like, leaving the offices, and he's on the street, an internal kind of, you know, sound of him thinking to himself, and he's like, after watching the footage, I couldn't help but think to myself, who's the real savages for them?
Dun, dun, right. Dun.
Yeah, and that sort of thing, which is, like, savages, of course.
Right.
But, yeah, like, huge commentary on colonial.
Of course. And is this considered a good film?
Oh, no, this is called classic.
Okay.
Yeah, exploitation.
Yeah.
For sure. It's one of the, like, I think it's one of the good exploitations.
Okay.
Where, like, it's brutal and it's awful and it is, like, so exploitative of so many things.
Right.
Especially in a 60s context.
Right.
But there's still something, like, clever being done there.
Right.
It is still, like, I think, effectively critiquing, even though it's doing it by kind of taking pleasure in it in a certain way, which is always the difficulty of any sort of exploitation film.
Yeah, it's and I mean, it's playing on the tropes still, so it's yeah. echoing that. What other films from that period?
Blaxploitation.
Yes, that we're familiar with. But what other movies, you know, try to...
There's a ton of exploitation genres, if that's what you're talking about.
Well, I guess I'm making special reference to the period that we're talking about.
Right. I mean, in this period, exploitation was a huge thing.
Mm-hmm.
So just to, like, rattle off a few types, there's nunsploitation.
Nunsploitation?
Yeah, there's sexploitation, of course.
Sexploitation.
There's women in prison films.
Okay.
There's Nazisploitation.
Okay.
Yeah, well, you know, that's like Ilsa, She Wolf of the SS.
Oh,
like,
gotcha.
You know, Nazi
yeah.
exploitation.
Yeah.
Spreading like crosses of those genres.
Yeah.
Right? So like in films would not uncommonly Nazi exploitation sometimes.
Yeah.
Because like Nazi prisons and all of these are just, you know, largely absurd. I mean, nunsploitation, how is that a thing? But it is, you know.
I'm kind of interested in how you can nunsploit.
Well, I mean, typically, from my understanding, is and I haven't seen one exploitation at one point. Nunsploitation is a subgenre of sex.
Okay.
So it's like nuns
the corruption
and sexy
of,
situations.
Right. Yeah. Sexy situations.
Yeah.
Interesting. That, I mean, we talked about this briefly before we started recording in film studies. I've talked about your knowledge about that.
So we had one course that did it very rarely. Label it as a film course. They labeled it under like women's studies or whatever else. I think it was different every now and then. It was actually an English teacher who taught it. Weird connections.
Yeah,
through.
An interdisciplinary field.
But they were trying to discourage people. Oftentimes, of course,
yeah.
porn, you'd be like, so many undesirables, unfortunately, are going to be like, yes, that sounds like rocks for jocks, but rocks in a different way. They're trying to hide it. You know,
right.
by doing that, and there's always issues about where they... the analysis of porn has a very strange relationship to... And for a number of reasons, like one of them is kind of the intention of to titillate, usually. The basis of it is different than what
right.
films are typically made for.
Right.
Or at least what we would think films are typically made for. And like exhibition modes are different, distribution modes are different.
Right.
Production modes are different.
Of like, course, budgets are different.
Yeah, yeah. The artistry functions in a totally different way.
Yeah.
Porn is really, as you can see in how that's shown, uncommon to think about porn as sort of a checklist.
Yep.
Did we get these angles and these positions?
These shots.
And these nice shots, basically. And so it has a very, it's not like film. So when you approach it, you have to approach it from a totally different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't really build into, like most people who do films engage with
it. Are the your classical films that you have to study, you know, whether you like them or not?
Everybody watches Citizen Kane at least once. I told you this story earlier.
Yeah.
There's a friend of mine who, when I was graduated, I saw he posted on Facebook this photo of the RKO, you know, intro banner, RKO Radio Pictures, a new screening room we'd had at the university there. Went with it, was sitting, like, getting ready for my fifth screening of Citizen Kane in this program. Which I should also add, like, this is a dude who was in the same program as me, so three professors... over 4 years, and that's his fifth time watching that film.
Amazing.
So it comes up a lot.
Yeah.
Know.
What about The Grapes of Wrath? Does that ever come up?
I haven't seen it.
No? I mean, I took a course on American culture, and it was something that... it was more of like, you know, the Dust Bowl era, Hollywood production, white America, basically. So.
I always think of it more in terms of the movie. I don't know how well regarded it is.
It was one of those kind of situations.
Oh, wow.
And as an undergrad, I tried to take advantage of all of those opportunities. What was the best course you've ever taken so far in your career?
I took a cinema and time.
Yeah.
It was called Cinematic Time. That's for mine. She's actually publishing a book.
Mm.
I think it's coming out later this year. One of those situations where the professor is like currently just researching it and just like, you know, hammering this work for themselves.
Yeah.
And let's talk about it together. My courses are increasingly becoming that. Yeah, that's a really great class. I mean, I have a course with her years earlier.
Yeah.
One of my first film courses I ever took. It was on a very similar idea. It was called Film History, but it was not about film history. And the first class was just about different names we could call this class, basically.
That's amazing.
Right? And, you know, like geography of cinema,
yeah,
time and cinematic history, blah, blah, blah. Like,
and going, you know, on, yeah.
And that's sort of what this course was, but just kind of more honed in. One of the things that was really missing on that first class was watching.
Yeah.
And like how, what consideration in this last one. And it's a cinema I'm particularly drawn to.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always really nice. They're nice. They're, you know, I don't watch them a ton because they're not, you know, really fun. Kind of suffering. But not
for the audience?
Yeah, not in a bad way.
Yeah.
It was just like life is suffering, you know?
Yeah. So if you were to design a film studies course, I'm assuming you would include cinematic time in there,
right.
Seminar.
Yeah.
Include slow films.
The thing that's really interesting about like cinematic time in general is that even like that slow cinema issue is just one part of it. Because when you're talking about like cinematic time, we're also talking about the way history and time is represented in film.
Mm-hmm.
People often don't think about this, but some films are real time.
Right.
And it's like, it's an hour and a half
in
the thing. But most films are not like that, right? When you're watching a film, it could take, that film can literally span anywhere from a couple of days to a couple of years to a couple of decades to a couple of centuries.
Yeah.
Like movies like, I think, spans, you know,
Boyhood.
Millennia sort of things, right?
Years as well.
So time gets represented in film really strangely. History gets represented in film very strangely, like JFK. A classic example of dealing very specifically with a historical event and using historical footage in it, but also recreating footage to look historical as well.
Yeah.
Right. So you have like a cinematic mode and then actual historical footage all working together to comment on an issue that actually is still on the American mind.
Yeah.
What happened to JFK. So all of these, and even just how our memory is represented, how is thinking represented, kind of like subjective time.
Yeah.
And thought space. So it's a very big area. And most of those feed into what I'm interested in, which is it's not like a reception. I'm not too interested in reception, but it's kind of pushing towards reception, how people make sense of what they watch. So oftentimes we'll just kind of take running assumptions about how we make sense of what we watch.
Right.
And different theoretical approaches may have a different position on that, but usually it's an ideological position, and it's how we ideologically, like what we understand ideologically, not what we understand content-wise.
Yeah.
And the formalists are, like the Boardwells or whatever, they're just a little too obvious. They're usually building most of their theories off of cognitive psychology, which is, to put it simply, it's kind of a normative version of understanding things. And I don't know if people, I don't know how people feel about statistics, but I don't care for them. I remember very specifically in a psych class, we had to do a study, and at the end we had to do this, some statistical analysis on it and give our findings. And I remember, just because of how the statistics worked out, I could not believe this. The kind of average was a position nobody in the study had taken.
Oh.
Right? So, like, the kind of quantifying everybody's answers and then making a statistical representation out of it was something nobody chose.
No one selected. So how is that? So it's,
how can that possibly be a normative, right?
Yeah.
And I'm sure, like, there'd be a way where
the median,
if you have and if you have like a better statistical approach, like
we're
undergrads,
size,
we're undergrads in this really, you know, garbagey class studying each other. So obviously my frustration is a little unfounded.
Yeah.
But I still think it points to an overall weakness in statistical models, which is it, you know, it takes everybody's complexities and puts it down to a number and then runs those numbers through some algorithms to get at what people do.
Yeah.
And they're normative. They're not normal, right?
No.
And so most of what Boardwell does is normative. And even when he talks about things that aren't normative, he sets it up in distinction to what's normative.
Yeah.
To ensure he's always correct.
Yeah.
Which I find highly disingenuous. But I'm more interested in understanding how films are constructed to make meaning and how people understand them in relation to their own, like, personal history and time.
So do you consider Holy Mountain slow? movie? I know that you mentioned it earlier before we started recording.
Holy Mountain certainly has slow parts.
Yeah.
Whether or not it's slow cinema, I think so. Too much going on at certain points.
Yeah.
It can actually be quite frenetic, if I remember.
It's overwhelming.
It's very overwhelming.
Yeah.
Slow cinema is usually the opposite.
Yeah. It'll be underwhelming.
Like, yeah. But to the point of becoming overwhelming.
Yeah.
It's like there's a very fine art to it.
Wow.
When there's such little going on that even the smallest thing is just like, whereas Holy Mountain, it switches between modes.
Yeah.
So sometimes there's long, quiet moments where nothing's happening, but then there'll be moments where they're in that sort of, Jodorowsky hated hippies and the hippie movement he was far too radically left to be interested in that. One of the great things about the man. And one of those scenes, one of the kind of sequences in that film is, of course, that like kind of hippie arms manufacturing plant,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And when it cuts into that, it's just so quick and so, like, it's so maniacal and frenetic and frantic, and there's so much going on. There's a lot of kind of sequences like that.
Yeah.
So it certainly wouldn't be slow. Slow is something more like, there's actually a really great film. A lot of slow directors are, so Bellatar did Turn Horse instead of his last film.
Yeah, you were saying.
Xia Ming Lang did his film Stray Dogs, and I believe he said it's his last film as well. He's one of the great slow cinema directors. Tarkovsky's long dead. And there's other slow cinema directors, but they're kind of the biggest ones.
Yeah.
I think if you were to watch anything by these guys, it would be... Tarkovsky wasn't totally a slow cinema director either.
Right.
Because he was like Kierkegaard is to existentialism. Tarkovsky is to slow cinema, right?
Yeah.
Like, there's obviously that concern, but there's a lot more going on as well.
I know that we talked a little bit about... I asked you before we started recording what was to play or resonate with our audience.
Okay. So, it's with Denis Levant. It's Leo Carax. I have no idea.
Cruel.
C-A-R-A-X.
You probably got it right.
Yeah. I think he's a French guy. I've never seen... So Leo is a French director. He was kind of known for some films he did in the New French Extremity. It was a wave of extremely sexual and extremely violent films. It is pretty good.
Yeah.
Glaring plot holes aside.
Right, yes.
But Leo did one called Pola X, kind of extreme sexual scenarios. But this is one he did more recently, it was 2012, which is much longer ago than I realized.
4 years.
Yeah.
Wow.
When this movie came out, I mean, in 2012, this is, one of the greatest 2012 films. I think it's one of the greatest films in the last. The movie is doing a lot of different things.
Yeah.
One of which is just kind of nodding towards the history of cinema generally.
Hands
opening up. The film starts with shots of, but it's kind of an arbitrary point.
Right,
that we decided.
This is where it happened.
I think the date. The movie is about a world scenario. This is where, and that's anywhere from after studio.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a broad variety of types of things that are happening.
Yeah.
There's a lot of commentary just on the state. And so there's an intermission, which kind of breaks away from all of this. See this really beautiful, I think really fun, plays another character, of course. An amazing role, considering he did 13 or so characters in this film. And
here's one more role, so I'll just play a little bit. And it's him basically walking with...
Thank you.
that was the intermission for Holy Motors 2012. I think the end was pretty cool. Next character. It's really interesting how the intermission, again, you're like a love letter to the history. A very smooth transition. I do have to ask you what your take on the racial aspect, films in general, about big budget films, the ones that or try to reach the average even care. What's the point? As the field, I'm assuming, has a different perspective on films. Or the elimination of race.
And it's depiction of the KKK as a heroic.
Yeah.
So this unavoidable, at the core, not intentional racism, but sort of just like mm-hmm. And you can see that still in some older movies. So even at the like the historical base, the structural base, there's issues over representing race.
Yeah, and it's ingrained in the industry.
It is totally ingrained in the industry. I mean, one of the comments Mark said about the Oscars, even the Oscars' fault that they're so white. It's the industry's fault.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah.
You know, he is right. I mean, there are great, there is no question. But when the market is flooded, a white person getting a nomination is just higher.
Right.
You know, it's the industry that needs to be fixed.
Absolutely.
And the industry like
of
this.
Of course, yeah.
One of the things we often look at for kind of a historical look at cinema is kind of LA films. I think there's actually a name for them. I only kind of looked at historical film class and a film directors, and that's his main one. I can think of images from the film because it's actually a very like striking film.
Yeah.
Like, very striking. And the images in it for a long time.
The racism is ingrained in, not just in Hollywood, obviously, to boycott the Oscars, which is the, you know, the emblem. Hollywood, is significant. And maybe that, you know, targeting the big dog opened the door for opportunities for other minorities.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of interesting thing about what Chris Rock is doing. By saying it's not the Oscars' fault, it's the industry.
Mm-hmm.
There's kind of two things that statement could be doing. And it could be trying to get the Oscars off the hook.
Right.
They're not responsible for this injustice. This is the group who is. But it also could be functioning to make sure that the aggression doesn't... Mm-hmm. I think he's right in the sense that it's not the Oscars' fault, quote-unquote, that it's because of the industry's inequality. It shouldn't take that pressure off.
No,
absolutely
not. No.
But the aggression needs to be placed at more than just the Oscars.
No.
Because it's an industry issue.
And boycotting all of those, you know, positive reward mechanisms within the industry would, you know, send a pretty positive message.
It certainly can. There's always for me, and like the main kind of central issue is money, typically, mm-hmm. in the industry. Last, I don't know how many years. Every blockbuster now is a comic book film. Because like comic books are a huge demographic, and they will go see that movie regardless.
Yeah.
And blockbusters set themselves up in such a genius way that it's kind of the you're missing out product.
Yeah.
You know, you see it because everybody sees it.
Yeah.
You can't miss this.
And the cultural reference that will come following.
Yeah, which will be dominating social media for the couple months after, and then kind of trickling everywhere else. For the, you know, the problem with that is it takes away any economic reason to,
exactly.
right? Because everybody's going to see it,
yeah.
you know? Like, how many people don't? You know, and they make these small gestures that people,
yeah.
I don't know how many times I've read, like, really pathetic article from a group that's supposed to be progressive that's basically, like, withdrawing a crumb, and they just eat it up. You know, like, yeah, this is, like, finally, like, we're getting some change. It never really is.
And it's not lasting.
Yeah. No. And it's not lasting. That's a big thing. There is an interesting comment Chris Rock made in an article, I think, for Variety or Hollywood Reporter or something. And he made a comment about arms of one of the companies and how, like, more, like... And he was talking about people of color having positions of power in these industries and how, like, that's needed. And then he made a comment about this production room and how it makes good movies. And then he said, even though it's a white guy who runs it, he's the type of guy who would watch these movies, and that's important. But it undercut everything, right? And it's that sort of thing, which is like, yeah, we could, a white person who was into all of these various things, but it's not going to change the ultimate issue, which is white people control all the kind of power and money in the system. It'll always... And this isn't necessarily because of an intentional racism on their part, but it's because they'll do what they know best.
And they know what makes money, and they'll continue to reproduce the conditions of production.
Yeah.
Would graciously say.
I mean, and that's another right? With most of my films from America are either in historical perspective because there was like explosions of it at certain points, like in LA, and from an American independent perspective because they were not industry,
mm-hmm.
right? They were independents because
mm-hmm.
they were not legitimized. Part of that problem is, back to maybe a more classical critique, you also can't just be mad at Hollywood for this inequality, because that inequality is based off of an economic inequality the general Western world has, which is these and people of color are put in worse economic situations and are therefore not as important economically for the product, right? If the majority of people with money are typically, you know, white people, systemic societal, like racist issues,
yeah.
then the economic for Hollywood to change is not exactly there, right? So it becomes back to like a, you know, classic class struggle.
Absolutely.
And racial issue, which and kind of modern things. Class struggle is always the bedrock of all these issues.
Yeah.
I think.
Well, you know, it brings into this perspective of, and gender.
It's, yeah, I mean, it's one of those interesting things. I read a book class, I had to do a review on one. It was a book, by a guy who did his dissertation on Slavoj Žižek.
I have a book of his somewhere here. I like him. He's a nutbag.
I do as well. He's a crazy nutbag. Bordwell doesn't like him.
Of
to kind of, yeah,
not,
give
yeah.
you an idea of how Bordwell sits.
Yeah.
in this book, he was kind of working to suggest, like, is there a kind of a coherent film theory, Žižek, or is it really just whatever?
Right.
And his argument was that there is a consistent approach that we could point to. But even more importantly, built into this book, I think actually the part I liked about it the most, the critique of modern leftism that was saying, by bringing class down to the same level as everything else, it's missing the fact that class is the structure. The class struggle is important not because it's just another inequality among inequalities. It's important because it's the inequality that is the like logical and ideological basis of the rest of the inequalities.
Right.
When everything comes down to, imagine, basically the kind of like the kind of othering and inequalities and oppressions that come from the class struggle
right.
are just repeated sexual race. Orientation, sexual identity, race, and all these things. It's a mirror image of that same thing.
Yeah.
And there's issues of intersectionality that are very important to keep in mind. Class usually gets brought into the intersectionality.
But also with other.
And I think what's interesting about his critique and what I kind of agree with, which is that it's more than just an intersectionality with class, though. Class is the foundation. Because class is kind of like a, I mean, in a society where it's election time and the economic position of the party is the most important thing.
Yeah.
And everybody's concerned about economy and the money coming from it. Everybody lives, like, seems pretty obvious that class would be that kind of foundational inequality. There's also a lot of complex issues surrounding, like, the typical classical Marxist superstructure and base relationship yeah. versus a Western Marxist understanding of that relationship. That there's always ideological justifications for the kind of social inequalities for each like,
yeah.
gender or whatever.
Yeah.
There's always going to be an ideological justification for that separate from class. But the question has to be in the relationship between base and superstructure for this justification and the social reality, what's the larger influence that kind of the general economic class inequality? Actually, that ideology. Typically, ideologies seem, a lot of ideologies seem to be
ideological more prevalent.
The other way.
Okay,
I think like the, I think oftentimes economic situations will create these inequalities
and then we'll
develop
the
ideologies
yeah.
and then that ideology will reinforce it
yeah.
and prevent the social from changing.
Yeah, and the ideology in a way becomes that intermediary or the invisible boundary. I mean, as the wedge grows, ideology will be the invisible barrier.
For me, I think in a lot of ways it feeds back to what, I remember this guy's name, I will be coming across with myself. He was, around Marxist time, developed the idea of anarchism. It's not going to come to me, unfortunately. I still remember I read something he wrote. It was in another class. Most of the stuff I read is still in because of classes, because
yeah.
I just have no time to read on my own yet.
Productive distraction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was writing about this idea that in a truly free, can't have slavery. In order for a society to be truly free, that just cannot be a free option, right? So even if you wanted to get into an agreement where something occurs where you're a slave for a certain amount of time, and after that you're not, and whatever benefit for you doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
Slavery cannot be an option. So in a totally free society, you are not free to make that choice. So in order for freedom to exist,
you can't have
that total freedom, right?
Right.
You can't have the freedom to take away freedom.
Or the opportunity to make that potential option.
And there's a sort of, you know, I think a lot of people would read that and think it's just like illogical or hypocritical or something. But I think there's a greater truth that's like at work there, which is like for, and really like there's an issue of equality there too, right? In order for equality to truly exist amongst any of the kind of intersectional positions that we'd want to point out, otherwise the logic of inequality will still be functioning.
Yeah.
In your society, and it will just create new inequalities in the same way for there. In order to have true freedom, it's unfreedom.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you so much for participating with the Academic Podcast, and stay tuned for our next episode. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks, Dylan. Any last remarks or?
But it is a director. He also wrote and acted.
Wow.
And they're pushing it for festival season this coming year. Conversation.
Absolutely.
Pretty well.
Yeah. And it, I mean, just the name alone and those basic movies that you talked that you mentioned earlier.
It's speaking really, I think, sharply to that history.
A recent uprising or a historic, like something in the past or?
Something in the past. I think it was actually, if I remember correctly, it was a slave uprising.
I think the
problem is that the director's name is similar to the historical figure's name, so I for.
Yeah.
Especially in a situation where you have to.
Well, thank you so much, Dylan. And an overall focus on film studies that we talked about today, but also I felt that you kind of gave us your perspective, not only as a film studies student, but as a critique of film. So I really appreciate that. And we will talk to you soon. Academic Podcast listeners.